Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Good morning, Dan Perkins here. I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a radio program that has evolved out of the award-winning book dedicated to helping small business leaders increase their profits. We draw our name from a book named Best Small Business Book of the Year for 2017 by Independent Press. Recalculating features the contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all whom offer the ways to grow your small business.
Well, you know, Dan, we've been talking a lot about the needs of small business and managing their employees. And today we have a guest that's going to really explain it even further. Tell us about him.
Well, it's Craig Vandenberg, Chief Operating Officer of Trion Solutions Incorporated. Good morning. How are you, Craig?
I'm doing well. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good morning to you both.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your business and a little bit about your background.
Sure. Be happy to and appreciate the opportunity. As you mentioned, I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Trion Solutions. We're headquartered in Troy, Michigan. You can find us at www.trionworks.com. And what Trion does is we're a professional employer organization, or commonly known as a PEO. And what we do is we partner with small businesses, generally kind of the definition of the SBA, businesses that usually have less than 500 worksite employees or employees. And we allow them to outsource their human resource functions, including payroll, employee benefits, workers' compensation, employment compensation management, HR consulting, risk management, tax compliance, and the like to us, and allow them to focus on running their business. I'm sorry, Donnie, you still with me?
I'm with you. Do you hear me now?
I can hear you great.
Okay, now somebody's coming back on. But anyway, my question is, the first question is, why would a small business want to partner with someone with a company like yours?
Sure, that's an excellent question. Most of our clients partner with us because they've thrown too much of a burden internally at administering all of the variety of functions associated with being an employer. That includes payroll and tax compliance, workers' compensation, employee benefit management, and it allows them to outsource those functions to Trion and then use their staff to run their core business, which may be a flower shop, a restaurant business, a hotel, a widget maker, and just focus on their core competencies and allow us to handle all of the compliance on the back end.
Craig, Dan Perkins again. I'm fascinated about the outsourcing. Do you do that on the cloud for the customer, or how do you do that for them?
Well, what we do is we have a couple of different models of how we support our clients depending on their requirements and needs. We do have, through our client web portal, the ability for clients to interact and do things such as submitting payroll information, allowing employees to enroll online in the cloud, whether it be just coming on as a new employee or if they're coming on to enroll initially or in their annual renewals on employee benefit programs, enroll in 401k, for example, enroll in healthcare benefits. You can do all of that through the cloud. We have electronic time and attendance through the cloud that allows employees and managers to keep track of different work sites and time and attendance. And then the clients get the chance to sign off and approve all that on a pay period basis. So we're trying to bring technology to the forefront for a small business that without our partnership couldn't leverage the ERP and IT infrastructures that you would see in a large company. We bring them to a small company.
So who is your, what's the profile of your typical customer?
So our typical customer is what we like to call Small Business America, usually anywhere from maybe 25 employees up to about 500. They tend to be one or multiple locations. They tend to be a business that has very limited or strained resources handling the functions that we manage. And when they outsource to us, it allows them to focus on their business while we throw a team of experts that include attorneys, accountants, certified payroll professionals, certified benefit professionals, and the like to manage those functions for them.
And is it all of your services performed over the web?
We do a significant amount of our services over the web, but we also do a decent amount of on-site client service. We also show up at the worksite with clients when they would like us or request us to be there. Some clients like their, for lack of better words, we'll say a little more hand-holding, where we'll do employee benefit enrollments at the worksite, or we'll do a combination of worksite and through the web. And in some cases where we start having clients that have some, perhaps some safety and health issues, we'll go on site and help them manage and work through with the management team to improve that worksite.
So how many years have you been in business?
We've been in business for 15 years.
All right.
And we manage, we work with about 600 client companies, and we pay and manage and assist about 30,000 what we call worksite employees.
Wow. How many people do you have on your staff?
We have just over 100 professionals inside Trion Solutions. And again, what we do is we have teams of specialists and a variety of different competencies that when we go to market, sell them as a generalist to the small business because everybody has a little different need or different requirement as they use our service.
Okay. And how do you charge for your service?
So generally, and this is a kind of an industry norm, we provide our services as a pass-through of wages and a markup that includes a percentage for administrative fees. Usually that fee is less than hiring the staff internally that you would need to perform all the functions we do and provide all the services that we do.
Yeah.
And again, it's, so, we're just leveraging economies.
I'm sorry. I apologize for jumping on you there.
Not a problem.
One of the things that is almost in the paper every day, and it's the reason why I ask you the question, what percentage of your business is dependent upon the web? when you outsource to an organization like yours, as a small business person, I have to be watching the news and seeing all the hacking going on and the worldwide ransom is going on and there's now these guys who've ransomed the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie and they want to Disney pay ransom and Bitcoin and they said no, we're not going to do that. What do you say to your potential prospective customer or to your existing customers? How secure is my data?
Sure, it's an excellent question. We have significantly high auditing standards that we use internally and externally from a security standpoint. You mentioned a good example where you had somebody like the Disney Corporation that was even hacked. So to suggest that any company is impenetrable would probably not be a factual statement. But at the end of the day, we invest significant amounts of money and resources into security. We have IT partners that focus significantly on protection, firewall security, data security, confidentiality. We hold ourselves to an audit standard that our clients, who are small businesses, would most likely never hold themselves to. So by holding ourselves up to that higher standard in the area of security and data integrity, we hope and we expect that we're doing better in that area than our clients would be with their employee data on their own.
Well, in the 15 years that you've been in business, unless you're miracle workers, you've never had you've probably had some kind of a failure or a disappointed client. What did you learn from that experience, and what did you do to correct the problem?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. From time to time, whenever you're in the service business, as well as you focus on internal controls, policies, procedures, and strategy, from time to time, you don't meet an expectation. We focus significantly. We sit down in our management teams every week and strategically work on those small failures from time to time. Take away from that what the experience was for the client that didn't meet the expectations, and then try to turn that into a learning experience so that it doesn't happen again. I'm happy to say that it doesn't happen very often, but certainly the opportunity to learn and do better from a failure from time to time is something that we strive with.
If you had to describe who was the ideal prospect for your services, what would that company look like?
Well, the good news is we don't focus on a particular industry. We focus on small business. So that ideal client for us, again, is generally a small, privately held business. They tend to have, somewhere between maybe 25 or 30 employees up to 200 or 300 employees. They're having some challenges in the marketplace, recruiting, providing a high level of benefits and standards, technology, retirement programs, tools that employees are looking for in small business now, and we allow that client to take advantage of those opportunities and then allow them to focus on their business. So in turn, the payback for us is that there's a true value proposition that smaller business is receiving, and it tends to lead to a very long life with the clients, and we see it in client retention.
So let me follow that with another question. Don and I started this show. We had another show. It was mostly current events commentary. We started this show because of Don's experience in the Small Business Digest and my experience of managing money for almost 45 years with small business people. We did it because we thought that when Mr. Trump came into office, there could be a resurgence, a rebirth, if you would, of small business in this country. And I'm curious if you're seeing any movement on the upside, and what's the word I want, the enthusiasm for your customers about growth?
So that's an excellent question too. We're definitely seeing in our client base, and again, that's Small Business America, we're seeing a significant increase in enthusiasm in the marketplace right now. Hiring is up, I can tell you that. There's excitement about, I think in general, about the notion that as a small business owner, there are going to be some changes and reductions in regulatory compliance, perhaps repealing and rolling back some of the burdens that you have as a small business owner. So the excitement is there. I don't know that any one of our small business owners would say, not unlike your position, that it's moving as quickly as they thought it would be in a new administration. But we're there to partner with them, and we work with them not only through our own company, but as an industry, we partner through our trade association. We were just up on Capitol Hill last week, as a matter of fact, to continue to push and focus for the benefits of small business.
Go ahead, Don.
Oh, so we're talking with Greg Vandenberg. He's Chief Operating Officer for Trion Solutions. It's been very interesting. My question is, when a small business comes to you about thinking about using your services, what are the questions you ask them that you should know? And then the other side of it, what questions should they be asking you?
Sales professionals go out to the marketplace. We're trying to identify clients that are having challenges, and a lot of our questions are wrapped around, are you having issues trying to comply with, say, the Affordable Care Act? Are you having issues with workers' compensation management? Are you having issues with unemployment and tax management, payroll, just trying to administer and run your employee benefits programs? If those are all issues that a client is having, then they're a good target for us because we're looking for them to partner and outsource that to us. The flip side, generally what we see with a client, their questions are, hey, listen, whether we've worked with somebody in the past or we've always done this internally, their questions are, what does the change mean to me? When you take over all of these administrative functions, how do I handle employee benefit enrollment? How do I handle payroll? How do I handle tax compliance? How do I handle workers' compensation management? So there's a lot of questions that they have, but we show them that through the ease of working with us, whether it be through our client portal, with our technology tools, or with our team of professionals that we put on site from time to time, we can answer their questions. We then get the data that we need to prepare a quote for them, and if they choose to move to the next level, we start what's called the onboarding and enrollment process, where we get them onboarded as a Trion client, their employees in the portal, and then start allowing them to focus on running their business.
Well, let me ask you this. Since you employ so many people, are you able to give your customers, for instance, lower rates on health insurance and other services?
That's an excellent question. We definitely have a significant amount of buying power in the marketplace. Some of the things that we do pass on are things that include employee benefits, whether that's in the area of health care, dental, vision, 401k, and then other areas like employee. Every client we have is required to provide statutory workers' compensation insurance, and we certainly leverage our economies to reduce those costs there.
Well, what about when it comes to firing a person, who does the firing and how do you do it?
So our clients make decisions at their work site who they want to hire and fire locally at their work site. What we do is we essentially become their HR department. So we partner with our clients that in designing the onboarding process of when they want to go to the market and do hiring. On the front end, that may include helping to put together surveys, questionnaires, enrollment process, guidelines for hiring. But on the back side, if you want to fire somebody, that's a decision a client makes. What we do, though, is as their HR department, we have a team of HR professionals and attorneys that they can call and talk to and consult with before they make those decisions on terminating an employee. And that may lead to something like preventing a wrongful termination position, a discrimination or harassment issue, or it may even include helping to assist a client with the proper exit of an employee that may include designing and putting together a severance program or something of that nature.
When you look at what's going on in the world today and what's happening in the U.S., I ask you about what small business is thinking about the future. What are you thinking about the future?
Well, the neat thing about the business that we're in is, as an economy, the workforce is kind of continuing to evolve towards small business. Small business is growing probably at a faster rate than it ever has. About 70% of the workforce in America works for small business. So we see that continued growth. I think there's a lot, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of excitement in the marketplace that perhaps under the current administration, there'll be a rollback. It'll make it easier both in, say, for example, in the banking industry and regulatory areas to start a small business. So we're excited about the idea that our market and excitement about owning a business.
So as you look at the customer base that you have and your growth prospects, are there particular positions that are in very short supply?
No, I wouldn't say so. You know, one of the things that we know that is going to is a constant is change. And certainly that happens in the employment arena for small business. You know, right now there's, as I think we're all aware of, there's a, the House recently passed a bill to repeal and change or replace the Affordable Care Act. That's been sent over to the Senate, but the likelihood of that coming out of the Senate and looking at anything like the original House bill is probably slim to none. We were having those conversations in Washington, D.C. last week. So that's just the healthcare issue that needs to be continually worked on and monitored for our clients. So that's probably long-term in nature because healthcare will continue to evolve, and this delivery system through small business will continue to evolve. And that's just one area, one example. We see the same thing happening in the areas of unemployment compensation. For example, every state in the country is reviewing and looking at now paid medical leave. So if you're a small business that just happens to have employees in five states, you could end up in a situation where you have to comply with five different paid medical leave bills. So those are the kind of things that we do and monitor, and we'll take care of that for our clients.
So when you look at what's going on in your business and in your clients' business, is yours semi-recession-proof business?
We like to think we're fairly recession-proof. You know, when the economy's a little bit harder, clients look to us to help to reduce employment costs, maximize the value of the teams that they have. But when the economy's humming, you're adding a lot of heads, so that actually increases our revenues. So we tend to see some opportunities regardless of what the economy's doing. But we certainly are a promoter, certainly to see our clients grow, is to see love to see a robust economy for small business.
I'm thinking about how things might change and how that would affect your business. There is a great deal of discussion that as this economy recovers, many jobs what humans are doing are going to be replaced by robots. And have you thought about that and what are the particular challenges of a robotic society?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question. It's interesting. I think about it a lot. We think about it as a business a lot. Although what we tend to see as well, though, is a lot of those changes happening more so at the much larger business level for now and for the interim foreseeable future, where you might see 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 employees. Small business tends to be the outlet where you're reducing costs for products and services. You don't have necessarily always the capital investment to grow your small business, so you're throwing human capital at it. So I think those changes will occur and continue to happen. But I think, you know, as it relates to the market that we go to in small business, you're going to see that happen at a little bit slower pace than, say, a Fortune 500 company.
I'd like to jump in and ask you a question. There, we've had a couple of guests on our program talk about the gig economy and how that's permanent. What's your take on it? We're getting close to the end, but I'm curious what you think about how that's evolving and how you might be part of it.
Sure, that's an excellent. I mean, personally, I've been paying a lot of attention to what's going on in the gig economy. I think there's an evolution to an extent, for sure, to see if to see if you can make the workplace more flexible to those giggers, I guess we'll call them. And, you know, the folks that are in college nowadays are coming out. They want more flexibility. They may not want to work for one employer on a long-term basis. The challenge that I think and we as a company think is going to continue to happen in the gig economy is regulators are extremely uncomfortable with the notion of independent contractors, which is essentially what you're seeing the argument for in the gig economy, where you tend to not have the protections of necessarily always paying into the proper tax bases, into unemployment, into workers' compensation. So I think it's going to be a challenging transition to support the argument on the gig economy that that it makes lots of sense from a flexibility standpoint, but at the same time, you can keep regulators and legislators comfortable.
Well, Craig, we've been talking with Craig Vandenberg, the Chief Operating Officer of Fron Solutions Incorporated. And Craig, give us a website again where people can get a hold of you.
For sure. And that is Trion Solutions. And we're at www.trionworks.com.
Site with this interview. We'll put that web up on the website with our interview with you, Craig. And thank you so much for being with us. And now it's time for our sponsor.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful. Now it's time for Money in Motion. Dan Perkins is our resident expert in making the money you earn work as hard as you do. Here is Dan Perkins.
Well, Don, we have a market that doesn't want to go down. And we have a meeting next week with OPEC on what to do. We had a situation where the oil markets sold off from their interim highs of about less than $54 down to $45, $46. News came out yesterday that OPEC is considering extending the production cuts into 2018. I'm not sure that extending the production cuts 1.8 million barrels a day is enough. We'll find out next week. The market rallied about 3% yesterday when the news came out about the possibility of extending the production cuts. But it's not done very much early this morning. So I expect we're going to be in a fairly stagnant position until we hear what the outcome of the meeting is next on the 25th. Now, the scenario, as I said, is that OPEC wants to extend the production cuts for another up into 2018, which would take at least 12, a total of 12 months from the start to the end, maybe as much as 18. The International Energy Agency is reporting that actually production went up on a global basis, even though OPEC cut in the first 90 days of this year. I think it's interesting, a couple of interesting facts about oil production. Right now, the United States has almost twice as many rigs drilling for oil and natural gas as it had 12 months ago. 12 months ago, and I know it seems like a long time, we were at the end of the world when crude oil was down around $26 a barrel. So a lot of people are drilling for oil in the United States, not so much everywhere else in the world. I think Saudi Arabia added one or two rigs. I think that's beginning to show as their revenues have declined so dramatically. They just don't have the money to take care of their people and to drill for new wells and new sources of oil and, more importantly, maintain the pipelines they already have. So I would expect to see in the next 12 months, if crude oil stays in the 45 to, say, 52 range, We're going to see more shutdowns or breaking of pipelines and stopping of flow because the OPEC nations just don't have the money to maintain their facilities or their pipelines. Most interesting thing that I saw in the last week was how much it costs to move a barrel of oil out of the Dakotas. The pipeline is not open yet. It's going to bring that oil through a pipeline. That oil has been shipped in the past by tanker cars, a lot of it on Warren Buffett's railroads. I saw a report over the weekend that said that the cost differential between shipping a barrel of crude oil over the continent in pipelines versus trains is $3 a barrel. $3. That's a huge amount of money, given the amount of oil. So as that Dakota pipeline comes on, the cost to lift and transport of that Dakota pipeline oil through a pipeline is going to drop dramatically, because not only is the $3 barrel going to switch to something much lower than that, they're now able to drill wells in the Dakotas in 3 to 5 days. 3 to 5 days, they're able to discover oil. So they've become immensely more efficient. President Trump is expanding the market for American oil. We're now exporting over 1 million barrels a day and growing. China is going to be a big customer. India will be a big customer. So we're taking market share away from OPEC. The jobs are coming. As far as the pipeline jobs, people are being hired. The question is that the markets tend to be a leading indicator as opposed to a coincident or lagging indicator. So you're going to see the reason why this market is going the way it's going is that it's telling us that the market looks 6 to 9 months down the road to the fall of 2017, things are going to continue to be pretty good. So I think you have an opportunity to invest. I'm telling my clients, however, until this situation with China is resolved, I'm going to sit on my cash. That's my
now, Dan, let me ask you a question. Ford yesterday announced that it was going to reduce its worldwide workforce by 10%.
Right.
Our guest that was just on said that small businesses are hiring. What does that in about the minute we have left? What does that tell you about the future?
Well, the mechanization in the automobile industry, which has been around a long time, they're getting more and more robotics into the system, so they need less and less people. As you and I have talked many times on both of our shows, the implication of robotics in heavy manufacturing is something that we're going to have to live with. And if Ford can use robotic technology to expand its production, it should do that. There was an article recently about a plant in Pennsylvania that's going to build robots. And they're saying it's going to have 12 to 15 people in the whole place. So robotics is something that we're going to have to live with going forward. Back to you.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Why don't you tell us a little and our listeners a little bit about you and the name and website for your business and how you got started?
Yeah, wow, that's a great question. So I work for a firm called Commerce Street Capital. They're based in Dallas, Texas. The website is www.commercestreetcapital, just like it sounds, .com.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a full service investment bank. We do mergers and acquisitions, so we help business owners sell and monetize their business. We help businesses buy other businesses, and then we help businesses raise capital or financing or anything sort of in the raising money realm. We also do a bunch of valuation work and some other just general advisory work. Most of the managing directors, including myself, sit on boards of companies and just are constantly giving CEOs, CFOs, and boards just solid advice on whether it's growth or decisions they're making in their businesses. Because many times, as a lot of times senior management is not getting the information and the advice they really need because employees are afraid to speak up or perhaps give them bad news that they otherwise just don't want to hear. So we try to provide those kinds of services as well.
How long have you been in business?
Commerce Street's been in business since about, 1986.
Wow.
I've been doing this for about 15 years. We have about 60 professionals, not all in the Dallas office, but that's where our headquarters is, and that's where most of the professionals are.
The reason why we started this particular show was because we believe that with the change in administration, there was going to be an opportunity for almost an explosion of small businesses. And we think that that's beginning to happen. The data that we've been seeing is that there are businesses for sale and a growing number of businesses starting. So what dynamics are you seeing today that are different than what they were, say, 6 months ago?
Yeah, God, it's a great question. I mean, it's depending on where you look. I mean, we are seeing a lot of people, starting businesses. But we're also seeing a lot of businesses just grow. I spoke recently on CNBC and was talking about, M&A and the Trump administration. And one of the things that I think we're seeing is just capitulation amongst business owners to, I call it diversify their wealth, but to monetize their businesses. Because, anytime the Dow is at 20, 21,000, valuations are just really, really high. And as we've all seen in business, there's the argument, well, you hold on a little bit longer and see where it goes, but we've all seen kind of ebbs and flows in the market and ebbs and flows in valuation. So we're just seeing a lot of business owners, sort of dip their toe into the water to see, what their business perhaps is worth, what kind of buyers are out there. And as it turns out, there's a lot, right? You have dry powder, which means that private equity funds have capital that they have not deployed yet, and there is a competition amongst them to find good, solid businesses. And so as a result, they're willing to pay more, generally speaking, than you might otherwise get in a normal capital environment. So the trends that we're seeing is when you look at the potential of tax reform, you look at infrastructure spending or the proposal of more infrastructure spending and just general positive business climate in the Trump administration, I think it's a very positive thing for businesses and in what we do in M&A.
How does someone who owns a small business prepare a small business to be acquired?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, there's several things that, one can do. It includes, the big key to everything is making sure that you are prepared, because what happens is that if you're not prepared, that can create an issue in, your particular valuation. So here are some of the things that I think about, right, when preparing to sell a business is, one, just understanding from a valuation standpoint what your company is worth, right? Because there's times where we go into a situation where, the CEO thinks the business is worth $100 million, and, from our perspective, it's 50, and we're miles apart. I mean, one of the things that we do is we make sure that, you know, we are data-based. So what I mean by that is that if we come up with a valuation or we help a CEO or a board come up with a prospective valuation on their business, you know, we're using data points that, you know, when someone else is reviewing this company, we can say, hey, look, this is what we think the value is worth, and here are data points to show that. Now, we may get more than that, and someone may be willing to pay more than we've seen historically, but we try to use data points, and there's a lot of data points out there to come up with a valuation. Secondly is to make sure that your books are in order. You know, that's very, very, very important, because when companies, when companies look at your business, you know, they want to see a company that's sophisticated, that have their books in order. They understand their business. You know, if the manufacturing company, do they understand price per SKU? You know, do they understand what all the ledger items are? Where are expenses going out? Where are the revenues coming in? Those kinds of things. Because if someone's going to get a great value for their business, the one of the ways they're going to do that is if someone's going to pay more money for your company, they want to know that you are well-run and sophisticated. If you're not well-run and you don't have your books in order, you're not going to get a premium for your business, and that is ultimately what you want. You know, just getting your paperwork organized, right? Because what will happen is if you go into a potential sale, you know, the prospective buyer is going to want to see a bunch of documentation. And if it takes you 2 months to get it, again, that's a signal that you just don't know your business or you're not prepared, whether it's, you know, corporate documents or financials or, you know, your building lease or, you know, contracts with clients or customers, distribution, and so on. You know, get an advisory team in place, right? You know, understanding what the process is. You know, it's never our recommendation for a business owner to just handle the sale himself or herself. And the reason is because it's like selling a home, right? I mean, someone can walk up to your front door and say, you know, hello, sir, I want to buy your house for X, but maybe it's worth more than X. Maybe it's worth Y. And so you want to run a process to, you know, create some excitement to get people to bid on your business. And if you have 6 or 7 potential buyers, you're going to have people paying more than they otherwise would if it was just a single person for a single transaction.
A lot of people talk about that this, my generation, the baby boomers, are going to represent the greatest wealth transfer in the history of this country. And we have a lot of post-World War II men and women who started businesses in many different fields who are now reaching retirement age and are looking to possibly sell their businesses. But one option that we could explore is whether or not an ESOP makes sense as a way to sell your business.
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility. It's depending on the type of business too, will depend on whether an ESOP makes a lot of sense. It's definitely, and it sort of depends, right? I mean, if you're looking for something, some kind of monetization of the business, it's you're not going to receive all of the worth of the business upon closing of the transaction because of the way the ESOP is set up. It's more or less kind of a loan to the business. So, you know, you have a note and you have, you know, the CEO or the business owner kind of on the hook for that loan, right? Because you're basically issuing shares to your employees. Mm-hmm. And so there's a huge responsibility of the CEO to sort of maintain the integrity of that ESOP, i.e. the financial worth, the credit worthiness of that ESOP. Mm-hmm. And so if a CEO is looking to just, you know, take, you know, $50 million and run, an ESOP is not the way to do it. It's also very complicated. It's very difficult to maintain. There's just a lot of work involved in doing that. But, you know, that being said, it's definitely an option. It's just a very complicated and legal intensive document or a process. In addition to that, you know, you need a valuation every quarter because, you know, if an employee leaves, you know, you need to buy back their shares. So you got to price, you know, what the ESOP shares are worth. And so there's just a lot of work involved.
Do you help a small business get their house in order up front before you begin to look for possible buyers?
Oh, yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, so the way our process generally works is you know, obviously there's a due diligence stage, you know, ahead of getting engaged with a client. So, you know, those conversations are learning about the company, you know, finding out kind of where they've been, where they're at, where they're going. Do the personalities fit? Do they want to work with us and do we want to work with them? What are they looking to do? Is it a closable transaction? You know, are people realistic about the process and those kinds of things? And then once we're engaged, the way it typically works is that we send our client an information request list. And that's a document that, you know, here's all the information we need. And so what happens is by doing that, it makes them prepared because they have to prepare it for us. So some of the documents we request are for presentations that we have to put together. And that one of the presentations is just what we call a SIM, but the SIM is essentially a presentation of the company on where they've been, where they're at, where they're going. So if someone, you know, if we send an email and say, hey, are you interested in buying this business, they can read this document and understand it and understand the business. The other thing that we create is a financial model. And that kind of serves two purposes, right? One is that if you're sending this out to prospective buyers and your, you know, last five-year financials are in there, you have projections, your balance sheet, you know, line item by line item of your, you know, your ledger and so on, a prospective buyer will look at this and go, wow, like these guys really know their business. They're really prepared. You know, they really are sophisticated. But it also allows a prospective buyer to take that model and then manipulate it based on what they plan to do. So if they plan to buy the business, the capital structure is going to look different. So they're going to look at that and go, okay, well, if we put in $50 million and we put $25 million of equity and then $25 million of debt, this is what the capital structure will look like and can, you know, how quickly can we pay that off? And we can adjust these expenses and, you know, projections look like this, and they can manipulate it, right? So it helps them, it speeds up the process and so on. And then, you know, then that's really where the discussions start, right? So prospective buyers will call us and then they'll ask us questions about the business and we'll answer them. And then, you know, we, you know, 50 people down to 12, and then we'll get those 12 in front of our client. We'll have more discussions. And then, you know, we'll get to more formal processes like an LOI and so on. But part of the reason we collect all that information is because at some point we're going to create a data room. And a data room is a warehouse of all the documentation of the business. So when a prospective buyer comes in, he can go into that that warehouse, that data room, and see all the documentation. So, again, we are helping them in that sense. And we also, you know, take the burden off of them in selling this business. We also give them good advice, you know, avoiding the pitfalls because there are unsavory people out there that just don't operate above board, you know, and just benefit from the things we've seen over time.
So are there businesses that are hot at the moment that are great candidates to sell?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. You know, I think in this environment, you know, there are some businesses that, you know, are, you know, hotter than others. But what I would tell you is that the way I answer the question is that a hot business is one that is very profitable and has historically always been profitable, right? That's what really drives buyers. So, you know, if you have a company that does, you know, 40% EBITDA, or 40% margins, you know, versus another company that does 10%, that 40% margin business is going to be much more appealing to prospective buyers. So, you know, when you look at historical growth and profitability, those are the two things that make a company hot or less hot. Now, there are certain sectors that, you know, people focus on, but for us, that doesn't make too much of a difference. I mean, you can look at any industry, manufacturing, healthcare, technology, consumer products. If you grow consistently and have decent profitability, depending on how much you've grown and how profitable you are, will make you less or more desirable to prospective buyers.
You think with the possibility of some are saying a true trillion dollar public-private infrastructure to rebuild the highways, the bridges, the tunnels, and the airports and schools. Does that change the evaluation potential for people in the construction business to build highways and bridges and tunnels and airports?
Yeah, I mean, no, there's no question. I mean, when you look at, just the comparable company. So when you come up with a valuation, so say, you know, you and I own a manufacturing business, like a rebar business that, you know, is completely affected by freeway construction or infrastructure spending. You know, when we look at our valuation, we have to base that valuation on what the public comparable companies are doing, right? That's how you come up with a valuation. You look at the public comparables, you use their multiples and kind of compare yourself to them. Well, you know, if infrastructure comparable companies, infrastructure public companies are higher, then that inflates your valuation as well. So as a result, it does do that. Now, I think that there's some hesitation at this point on, you know, how that infrastructure spending is going to look and whether it's actually going to transpire. But I think everyone is pretty bullish about that. And, you know, look, there's a buyer for everybody, right? I mean, we do energy deals. And, you know, that's not the hottest space right now because oil prices are so depressed. But there are a lot of funds out there who are really willing to run into a building when it's on fire. But then there's also folks who want to jump on, you know, industries like infrastructure spending or infrastructure where, you know, they feel that there's a boon coming and, you know, they want to participate in what the Trump administration is going to be doing.
Caterpillar Tractor or John Deere might be a good play in the public sector to play for road construction, bridges, and tunnels. And that public sector will, in fact, are you saying the public sector will influence the price of a small business to sell in that space?
100%.
I have two questions. One came over the internet, but as you may be aware, I sit on a medical marijuana nonprofit here in New Jersey. And my question is, do you think that medical marijuana will be a viable area in the next 2 or 3 years, or do you think that? Well, what do you think?
It's a good question. Again, this is my own opinion. I think it's further away. I think to have a real commerce, a real industry in place. I've seen people trying to get into this space and to create, you know, products and services around that. But I think it's further out than 2 years. I think it's probably closer 5 to 7 to have, you know, businesses that are really booming and, you know, and participating in that. I think it's further out than 2 years, in my opinion.
Which is, how do you deal with employees when you're thinking about or in the process of selling your business?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that we always think about in a process. And, you know, the bottom line is that you want to make sure you bring in the right buyer. So, you know, the CEO, you know, always has to remember that he or she holds the NUC codes in a deal. So, you know, CEO number one can come to us and say, hey, Gene, look, I want to sell my company and I want $100 million. And I can come to them and say, hey, look, not only did I get you $100, I got you $50 million more. and really deliver in that sense. But, you know, they could meet with the buyer and just not like this person and go, wow, you know, this guy's looking to do this with my business and he's looking to do that and he's probably going to fire my CFO and my head of marketing and so on and so on. You know, that CEO can just say no, right? So what we try to do is to bring in the right buyers because there are very friendly buyers. And so when I had mentioned, you know, what the process looks like, well, part of the process, as I mentioned, was getting the CEO or the board or all of the above in front of the prospective buyer. And they sit down and talk. And one of those conversations or one of those questions in that conversation is going to be, what are you going to do with my employees, right? And then, you know, there's things that you can put in contractually that, you know, ensure that, you know, certain people stay. You know, you can have employee contracts, those kinds of things. But, you know, there are ways to do that, and those are probably the top two or three.
I'm thinking about the small businessman who's had a successful business, very profitable, and for whatever reason, he or she decides they want to sell it. And you go out and you find him a great deal to sell his company. And 6 or 9 months later, they're all sitting around the table in your conference room and are signing all the documents and checks exchange hands. What does that person do the next morning when he doesn't have an office to go to? He doesn't have employees to work for. Isn't that a significant cultural shock for an entrepreneur who may have spent 30, 40 years building that business?
Yeah, gosh, that's a really, really good question. I mean, I would say typically there's a phase out. It's pretty rare where somebody buys a business as you described and the CEO the next day is just out of the picture. Typically, when someone buys a business, they'll want the CEO to stay on as an employee or a CEO or a consultant for, you know, anywhere from 3 months to 2 years.
Okay.
And so as a result, you know, that CEO then can phase out of the business and have it not be such a, you know, you're using more of a scalpel than a butcher knife in, you know, in exiting that business. And so, you know, as a result, you know, there's a more easier phase out than it is just, you know, cold turkey.
Yeah. Don, any other questions you have?
What happens if the owner goes all the way to the deal and gets cold feet? Do you see that happen? And what are the reasons for that?
Yeah, it does happen, unfortunately, because, you know, you put in 6 months of work and you get the CEO what they want and then they pull out. And obviously, you know, we're success-based, so we generally don't get paid unless the deal closes. So those are heartbreaking situations for us, as you can imagine, but they do happen. And the main reason I have seen this take place is, you know, there's just an emotional tie to that business. Right. You know, it's many times people's identity. You know, when they go to dinner or they go to a club or they go to a meeting, it's Bill at XYZ company. And he's been that person for 30 years. And so now that person is no longer has that identity. And, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow for many people. You know, there's also just that emotional tie of just, you know, you've worked somewhere 30 years and you're used to the consistency of it. And, you know, you just don't want that to end. And, you know, so those are kind of the main two reasons that we see people pull out or not consummate deals.
Gina, again, your company and how people reach you.
Yeah. So our firm is Commerce Street Capital. They can reach me directly two ways. One is my email address. So it's E as in Eugene Urcan, U-R-C-A-N. So E-U-R-C-A-N at C as in cat, street, cap, C-A-P.com. One more time. It's E-U-R-C-A-N at C, street, C-A-P.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.